Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. We're back. I don't know what we most recently talked about, but check out our website, MacGuffinMen.com. We're dealing with a compressed schedule today, so let's just get right to it. James.
Yes.
What are we talking about here?
We are at long last, for two different reasons, talking about the Man with No Name trilogy, sometimes known as the Dollars trilogy, sometimes known as the Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone spaghetti western trilogy.
Yeah, I love the term spaghetti western, by the way. I've been thinking about it a lot. It's because it sounds like something that Clint Eastwood, like a term that Clint Eastwood coined to describe the movie he was going off to shoot, but like he meant it in like this pejorative way. He was like having a steak, like a good American steak at a restaurant with his friend. He's like, so what are you shooting next? He's like, oh, I'm gonna go shoot a western with one of them spaghetti boys. Like, that just sounds like the beginning of the term to me, is that that is how Clint Eastwood talks about Italians, you know? Like, and I just find that really funny, and I couldn't get that idea out of my head watching these movies again.
Oh, no, that's 100% correct. Yeah. No, that is the origin of the term. No, it sounds so racist. It sounds so racist every time, and it is the most widely used term for this, even in, like, academic circles and film criticism circles.
Yeah.
Have you come across the term Euro-Western?
When I was on the Spaghetti Western Wikipedia page, yes, I did. I did a quick perusal of that, and that's about it for me.
Right, yeah, because there was, I mean, Westerns have been a part of cinema since, you know, the very early days of cinema. And so, you know, Spaghetti Western, I guess we can kind of start providing real information and not made up stories about Clint Eastwood. Was it a term to use to describe the Westerns made, obviously, in Italy, mostly in Italy, often with a Italian director and then a cast and crew, Spanish, mostly European people, and they would often use a fading American star or an upcoming American star, like Clint Eastwood, to be the protagonist, because you should probably have one American in a movie set in the Old West. Honestly, more than any other genre, Westerns are tied up with a very specific time and place. You know, even if you start listing subgenres of movies, they can still be pretty spread out geographically or temporally. But Westerns, just broadly, Westerns always mean, well, almost always mean American, and, you know, somewhere in the mid to late 19th century. And yeah, there's neo-westerns and all those things that we can get into, but I mean, for the most part, it's very specific to a time and place, and certainly a country. And they had been making westerns almost since the beginning of film. I mean, one of the most iconic early ones is the Great Train Robbery, that famous sequence of the cowboy pointing a gun at the screen that kind of got mixed up in cinema folklore as how dumb people used to be thinking they were being shot at, like the train coming at the camera kind of thing too.
Yeah, and that's also a notable moment in cinema history, because it's like one of the first close-ups ever used in a film. So that's another reason why it's very important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it just kind of shows we're a part of cinema. And so there had been this kind of subgenre called Euro-Westerns for a while, where people in Europe would make a Western, much an American domain. But there was, I mean, even the Lumiere brothers made a Western. You know, they had a story set in the Old West, so it doesn't get more OG cinema-wise than the
actual OGs.
Or whatever OG is in French. Maybe G.O., I guess. but I mean, Westerns kind of have this very almost sacred place in cinema. And I think one thing that is especially interesting about the relationship between the two is that one almost replaces the other. I mean, cinema did a lot to keep the myth of the Old West going. But around the time that cinema is being invented is around the time that the Western landscape is disappearing in any real social sense. I mean, you see this in Good, Bad, and the Ugly and Fistful of Dollars. They talk about when the trains came or when the telegraph lines came and things like that. That was really the end of the Old West. And that's really the beginning of cinema. And, you know, there's all the interesting stories of Tom Mix, who was an Old West star, who played Wyatt Earp a lot, going to the real Wyatt Earp's funeral. And some of these famous cowboys getting jobs at movie theaters, ripping tickets, come see the real cowboy, you know. So it's just this very interesting relationship between the two, these two concepts of, the Old West and of cinema. And, you know, as I said, there's kind of always Westerns, there's always Euro Westerns. But the spaghetti Western is really a change. And, you know, this trilogy of movies is very, very influential on spaghetti Westerns. It wasn't the first one, but it was really kind of the watershed moments all come out of this trilogy of movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when people think of, if anybody's thinking of spaghetti Western, one of these three movies is the first one that they're thinking of, you know, except for maybe Once Upon a Time in the West, you know, that might get in there, but still a Sergio Leone movie, you know?
Yeah, and there's one called Django, which is kind of seen as really important, but it doesn't really permeate mainstream culture the way that these movies do. I mean, if you think Old West, you're probably thinking, if you're picturing someone, you know, in a Western movie, you're picturing Clint Eastwood. There's definitely a great argument to be made for John Wayne or maybe, you know, Gary Cooper or Tom Mix or something, but
somebody our age is picturing Clint Eastwood.
100%. You know? Yeah. I think that's accurate. I think they would know John Wayne, but I think that's more of a, it's definitely Clint Eastwood and spaghetti Western. I don't think that there's an argument that Clint Eastwood is the actor. Sergio Leone is the director. Ennio Morricone is, the composer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just undeniable. So this trilogy is kind of a long time coming for us, I feel.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think we watched these movies together for the first time for both of us, like years and years ago when we lived together, and have loved them ever since, or at least I have. I don't know if you strayed, but they're good films.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we both like Westerns in general.
Also true.
True. So do you want to talk about what separates this from a Western?
I think it's just kind of this, the thing that exists throughout all of these movies or Sergio Leone Westerns in general is that they're just such an American form, like what you were talking about. They all take place in America and represent this specific sort of time. And they're just, it's somebody making one of those movies through the eyes of the way a European looks at America. And as such, is not, doesn't really feel constrained to the rules of such a genre as Western. Like, I mean, a John Ford Western could not look more different from a Sergio Leone Western. You know what I mean? And there's just such a, like, there's more of a stylishness to the Leone Westerns just because he doesn't feel constrained by the rules of an American Western. And if you look at European cinema in the time, at the time these movies are made, it's a very influential time. You know, you're talking about the days of Godard and Truffaut, people that would then set the tone for what American cinema would be in the late 60s and through the 70s until the blockbusters started to take over. And it was just this really, it's like the French New Wave, but, you know, an Italian working concurrently with that and having his own ideas. And so we get these really amazing extreme close-ups and so many shots of faces in these movies, like just an unbelievable amount. And it's just close-up after close-up after close-up. And then these like hugely wide vistas, you know, there's like, it's all macro and micro in this movie. There's like, or in these movies, there's no like middle ground. It's all these huge, beautiful things, and then these tiny things shot in this huge, beautiful way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think the escalation of violence is something that people point to Leone as being responsible for, and his kind of contribution to the Western. I mean, if we're taking Westerns and spaghetti Westerns, very generally, I mean, empirically, these were movies that were shot in Italy or Spain, you know, shot in Europe instead of in America, still always posing as America, but not actually filmed there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I said, national crew, international cast of actors, and... Yeah, I think, as you said...
frequently, like, the lead and the director cannot communicate.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll read these stories about someone who just happened to speak English on the crew functioning as a translator. Like, they didn't hire a translator. They just, one of these guys just happened to have some English knowledge. So that's who our star is going to talk to our director to. And it's all just happenstance.
Yeah, exactly. I think Eastwood and Leone talked mostly through the stuntmen in at least one of on at least one of the sets, you know?
Yeah. And so in America and definitely in America in the 50s, Westerns are the dominant genre. 1950s television is tons of Westerns. I mean, that's what Clint Eastwood was doing before these. He got his start in, well, not his start, but kind of got his career rolling on a TV show called Rawhide.
Would you say he got his career rolling on Rawhide?
Yeah, I would absolutely say so Westerns are big, and as kind of has been the way with cinema for a long time and up to this day, America is very influential in international cinema. And what was happening in the States is often what was being replicated outside of it. So in Italy and in Europe in the 60s, they are making Westerns. And making Westerns kind of as close to American ones as they think Europeans are going to be comfortable with. So they're making these very low-budget movies that are making money. They're not making a ton of money, but it's kind of like a low-risk, low-reward. A Western is... an easy thing to emulate. You know, you can replicate it over and over. You know, you just need some guns, some horses, somewhere that looks like Arizona or California.
And a poncho.
And a poncho. Yeah. Yeah, you can pretty much do it. So they were just making these movies for incredibly cheap, not necessarily, you know, going off the beaten path that much. And, you know, something successful, you kind of just keep replicating it. Mm-hmm. And... it was when, you know, the first of this trilogy comes out, Fistful of Dollars, and is successful that they, you know, more successful than, you know, the typical successful spaghetti Western. Mm-hmm. And they repeat that formula. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Leone did it with Eastwood, but a lot of other people were doing it in Italy and in Europe at that time. But this one was the, as we said, not the first, but definitely the most influential, and definitely a watershed moment when this hits the market.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree entirely.
Good. I'm glad you did.
Yeah. I like the story of Clint Eastwood seeing Fistful of Dollars for the first time because they wanted to sign him on for a few dollars more. But he didn't want to sign on until seeing what Leone could do. And he got his friends together in a screening room at CBS, I think it was. And as they were watching the movie, he's like, yeah, I'll work with this guy again, you know? And like, just, I like the idea of Clint Eastwood going to watch his own movie and having so little idea of what it's going to be, you know, that he's unsure if he wants to sign up for another, you know?
Yeah. And I think it wasn't even an English cut of the film.
No, it wasn't. It was Italian.
So not only does he not know what he's getting into, he kind of knows what doesn't even know what he's got himself into in a way, even after having seen it. And says, you know, this is enough to go forward with and continue. Mm-hmm. And I mean, these three movies were all released within a year in the States. They had their international and European releases pretty soon after they were made, but they didn't reach the States for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about that. I was like, could you imagine if three like movies that are so like so awesome and wonderful, like three like really great action movies like this, all in the similar style, were released within a calendar year, you know? Like, if you and I got to sit down and watch these movies for the first time in a theater over the course of 12 months just by within the natural release cycle, how crazy that would be. And probably would have exploded my brain in 1967. And then The Graduate came out that same year, which also would have exploded my brain.
Yeah.
December 1967 was a good time in American cinemas.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
So what, where do you want to start with this? I mean, I think there's a lot. I mean, we've talked about how kind of they came to be. I mean, Sergio Leone's dad was a very influential director as well. And he was doing Westerns as well, but they weren't considered spaghetti Westerns. As I said, there was kind of this Euro Western trend. And then it wasn't until the 60s that these spaghetti Westerns really kind of started to take off. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the violence. What else? Yeah, we talked about the violence. We talked about kind of that going between those extreme close-ups and the wide shots. Have you kind of thought about thematically what that the importance of those that macro micro relationship you're talking about was?
Absolutely. These are very small, you know, small movies to an extent. I mean, they're still action movies, they're still guns and death.
Yeah, and by The Good, Bad and the Ugly, there's a lot more money to throw around. And when I think about these movies, I think about, you know, nothing happening for a good 2 minutes as people stare at each other. But then you get these, it always slips my mind, but you get these epic depictions of the Civil War. I mean, you get these huge battle scenes. It's not just people standing around and staring, although there is a ton of that.
Yeah. That's what Leone excels at, I think. If The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was 3 hours of people staring at each other with Ennio Morricone music, I think I would like it slightly less than the movie that actually exists. You know?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it still would make a splash. I think they're following a formula where things build to a bigger action climax with higher stakes and just, you know, simply more people and action involved. But that's his strong suit. But yeah, I think what people forget about is how, not just the body count, but how big some of these set pieces are.
Mm-hmm. Especially in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But to go back to your question from a minute ago, the way that I sort of look at the macro versus micro thing is that even though these are not huge movies or telling huge stories for the most part, even when you've got The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, it still focuses very strongly on these three men and their journey from their introduction to the cemetery at the end. But the first two movies are very small as well, with the focus on a small number of people. But
or a town, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the thing with the way that these glances are used in such this grand fashion and the way the music swells throughout them is that even though it's just maybe two people in a standoff against each other, there's such a build up to it because it is violence. Like I view them as kind of anti-violence movies, or at least movies that want you to appreciate how big anytime somebody how big a moment anytime somebody is willing to pull a gun is. You know what I mean? Like it's very like, yeah, we're showing this violence, but also we want you to know this violence is kind of a big deal. You know, in this scene, one of these lives is going to end, you know, and it's not like there's this death is being treated as this thing that you can just throw off. There are certainly times where it's played for a laugh and whatnot, you know, pardon me, four coffins line popping to mind for sure. But yes, in the build up to these things, it's always something that Leone wants you to be like, hey, this is a big deal, you know, people are about to shoot each other.
Yeah, and we talked about it on, I remember specifically on The Shining, and I think it comes up and It Follows too, but you know, just to talk about horror for a second, there's the horror where it's like the jump scare, but then there's the horror like the moment in The Shining where she sees what he's been typing all this time, you know, the all work, no play makes Jack a dull boy. Mm-hmm. There's the horror of what has got us to this point. And I think that that's the way that violence is dealt with really well in these movies, is there definitely is the times where someone is holding, you know, a loved one in their hands as they die. But those are so few and far between when we compare them to the moments of someone is about to die. Like, let's all consider what choices we made to get to this point that we've all agreed that one of the two of us or three of us is going to die. Like, mm-hmm. They lived in a much different time where death was just a big part of their lives. And I think that that's something.
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
That's something that I always think, especially in, I guess, A Fistful of Dollars is a good example, but when two people are having a gunfight and there are just spectators. You know, mm-hmm. there's people just watching this who know someone is about to die. Just that idea that death is, you know, surrounding these people, and they just saw and experienced and were next to so much horrible death and violence. But yeah, those build up to the moments and the things that spaghetti westerns are famous for, you know, these Mexican standoffs, something that Tarantino definitely took to heart.
Oh man, Tarantino took everything in all of these movies to heart.
All of this to heart. Yeah. But no, just those moments of someone is about to die. It's not, oh, someone is dying, now let's consider this. It's there's this imminent death. Like there's death all around us. There's about to be someone that we know killed right in front of us. And I think that is one of the things that still makes these hit home and still like ring true to people who don't like Westerns, don't like a mostly slow 3-hour movie. That's the thing that still gets people and still has people on the edge of their seat, even though it's repetitive music and a lot of staring and not a lot of action. They do such a good job of making that moment tense and building up to that. And that sounds like a crazy understatement having watched these movies recently, because things do get so intense often, but I think that's one of the ways that this trilogy succeeds in a way that still reaches people watching it now for the first time.
Yeah, for sure. There's some sort of element that you just can't, seemingly cannot replicate, you know, that Leone had the magic potion for, and nobody else has had it since, you know.
Yeah, and I think with the macro and micro thing you were talking about, it's interesting reading people's immediate reaction to this movie when it came out at the time.
Which movie specifically?
Any three of these ones, like if how they were received in America and, you know, by the most respected film critics, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, Roger Ebert said, this is a 4-star movie, but I can only give it a 3 because it's a spaghetti Western and spaghetti Westerns aren't art, which is crazy. And the way people talk about it as not understanding a Western or taking out all the things that are good about Westerns and just amping up the violence or amping up, you know, certain elements of it, but really losing the heart of it. Versus the way that some people talk about it now as, you know, demythalizing or demythologizing, I don't know, whatever, you know, demything the myth busting.
That's it.
myth busting the Western. it's interesting because you don't know if that was Leone purposely genre, or if it's a poor imitation of the genre, or if it was some mistranslation or some communication error, because you know, there's so many different people coming at this movie from so many different angles, or if it was budgetary restraints that got them to this point. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting reading the way people negotiate it, and you know, with, you know, as far as taking the myth out of it, it's some people look at it as a very much a reaction to the John Wayne kind of movies where everything is so simple. All these Westerns where everything is so black and white, you know, the black hat versus the white hat. You don't even have to speak a language and you understand exactly what's happening. And there's just no subtlety and there's no nuance to it. Mm-hmm. I really do have a hard time giving Leone credit for doing all the things that people say it did 30 years after the fact. Mm-hmm. But there's undeniably deliberate choices that make these different than a Western. You know what I mean? There's just no way you can look at this and say, oh, he was just trying to make a John Wayne movie, but was too dumb and failed. Like, there's just... visually, there's all these choices that work so well. Musically, there's all these choices that make this movie what it is, that you can't, you know, you can hear people go overboard about everything Leone was trying to do. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that is just kind of accidental, to be honest. But mm-hmm. I think that you don't get those happy accidents without taking a very bold approach to filmmaking. And I think that that's, you know, such a reason why he's still credited as being successful and not just lucky.
Yes, I would agree. I too have sort of a conflicted opinion on Leone in general. Like I do feel like some of the things he lucked into, but some of the things that I love so much about this movie are so have to be so obviously present in the design of the movies themselves, like the style of the movies, like those close-ups. Like, those are the things I love the most about this movie. There's a million of them. They were obviously, you know, a part of Leone's plan from day one. And that's something that I think is something he definitely deserves credit for. Whereas, like you're saying, I some of the things are kind of just sort of luck or me saying a lot. Like, I was thinking about Fistful of Dollars, and, you know, in kind of in line with the way that we've talked about violence already, like, violence is such a big deal, and these movies want you to focus on these acts of violence, even when they're just between two or three characters. Fistful of Dollars is basically all about Clint Eastwood's character taking advantage of two families fighting a dumb war. You know, like, if you fight silly wars, you can be deceived and all your gold can be stolen, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was just thinking about that, and I was like, yeah, that's what this movie's about. I don't know that Leone knows that's what this movie's about, you know? Like, it doesn't feel like something that was present in the design, whereas all of these visual things, I think, are absolutely there from day one, are intended, and are successfully come across in the finished product. But a lot of the other things, I think, are very, very quick and don't really do a lot for me, you know?
Yeah, no, yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
And I think part of the way that I think his career after the fact, I think, really cements it for some people. Like, he continued to make a lot of Westerns and then made a lot that kind of just went into the low comedy, almost kind of spoofing the genre. And, you know, it's so tough to draw the line between spoof and satire and what's goofy and things like that.
Yeah, I've been meaning to see Once Upon a Time in America for about 10 years now, because that's apparently like his Godfather movie, and I just haven't seen it. And I feel like that will kind of close the argument. You know, like, depending on how I feel about that movie will change how I feel about pretty much every Leone movie, you know?
Right. Yeah. As far as influences are concerned, did you want to talk about Kurosawa and Yojimbo as far as the relationship to these ones?
I don't think I can offer anything, because I've never seen a Kurosawa movie.
Okay.
So, yeah. I've seen 10 minutes of Rashomon, and that's it.
So, okay. Well, there's a back and forth between the two, because this Fistful of Dollars, as you said, it's about, you know, this stranger who comes to town and has these two factions, families, whatever, fight against each other and for him to benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Which, from my understanding, is very similar to Yojimbo as well.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where, you know, Kurosawa sent Leone a letter saying, "You made a fine film, but it's my film." and won a trial, essentially saying that he got 15%. Kurosawa got 15% of the international money for Fistful of Dollars, and all the either Japanese or Asian money.
Grosses, like
international grosses, yeah. And so there was kind of a back and forth, and Leone said that, you know, this was basically, you know, Yojimbo is basically ripped off of a Dashiell Hammett novel called Red Harvest, and that there's kind of this back and forth about, you know, what's really the source of a film.
Yeah.
Which I think is very interesting. which, you know, is a question for all of cinema altogether, not just these two movies. Mm-hmm. But it just kind of speaks to that. And Leone was definitely aware of that movie and that much of the plot about it. It kind of just speaks to the fact of how much of this, like Fistful of Dollars and this entire trilogy came from somewhere else. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's undeniable that it came from the Western, but it's about how, I guess, back to that question of how much of it is not just taken from something, but how much of it is intentionally changing it or satirizing it, and how much of it is just an attempt to do that version, you know?
Yeah, or sort of put your own spin on things. And I think it comes back to the same thing we were just talking about, that I think Leone is a brilliant visual stylist and lucked into a lot of things otherwise, you know? Like, none of the scripts in these movies are you know, not no great thing, you know? I'm never going to read one of these scripts while I'm just, like, hanging in a hammock at a cottage, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a David Mamet play or something. It's hard to describe. That's the thing, like, because they're so visual and I can't say anything other than, well, just fucking watch it, you know? It's it's the most beautiful thing in the world, you know? Doesn't matter how smart it is necessarily, it's still wonderful, you know? It's like, because the Western of the time, at that time, is like the blockbuster, you know? And these movies, I think, still are today, like these perfect renderings of mass entertainment, because they're thoughtful in that there's a lot of thought put into the setups and how things are done. They're clearly not made by idiots, and they're not being just, you know, pushed through an editing machine trying to get them out as quickly as possible. But they are still very simple movies that are made in the style of the time that was, you know, aimed to get to the highest number of viewers, you know, even though it's a skewed version of that. It's some version of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny reading about the effect of this movie on spaghetti westerns. And again, this movie... I really don't believe Leone went out to, you know, change the game. You know what I mean? Like, I think he was doing his thing, and he definitely tried, and he tried very hard and succeeded. But I don't think he put, you know, a ton more thought of this into this as he would whatever other movie idea would have come along at the time. And it's fascinating reading about what happened after this movie and reading about kind of the templates that were built. You know, there's a pair of heroes very often now, because that worked successfully in this trilogy. You know, you'd have the clean shaven one and the rougher one. And this one was the moral one, and this one, but to the point where, and I'm just not the spaghetti Western super fan who's able to rhyme off the names of actors like this, but, it's the way that these movies are spoken about. It's, you know, this actor would often play the clean shaven bounty hunter, often to a villain played by this guy. Like, it wasn't even just that the rough plot was the same. The actors were playing the same characters. There was the same musicians. Like, it was so repetitive, just, you know, to speak to your point that it was so formulaic. But it just takes someone like Leone and, you know, Morricone, who I don't think we've credited enough with how entertaining these movies are.
Oh, no, he cannot be credited enough. Like, nobody, like, has written an article that gives him enough credit. You know, there's no piece out there just because it's so – his music is so important to these movies, and it's so good. And, these movies cannot be removed from the music. You know, the visuals and the music of these movies are of equal importance because they work together so well in concert. Anyway, you were talking. I interrupted. I'm sorry.
I kind of forget what I was saying.
I have no idea what you were saying either.
Listening to all the Morricone music in my head. It is such a visual... such an international style. I mean, because the music and because the visuals are the two things that are, I would say, far and away the most well-executed things about this movie, is that that's what made it successful for the international market. And just to tie into something that we kind of had both mentioned earlier about Leone kind of lucking into some of this, you know, definitely I'm not going to say that he's not a good visual director, because he is. And as someone who likes these movies a lot, I found watching them again most recently, I was blown away by some of the compositions of these shots. Like, the way that it's choreographed, that you start one place and come around, and just the blocking and the framing, is everything is so incredible. You can, as always, do a better job of elucidating why how the visuals are so successful. But one of the things that I think he does luck into is the way that these movies were made, and kind of the way that this is a loose trilogy, I think is one of the things that works out so well. I mean, I'll ask you, what makes these things one trilogy? Why do we talk about the Man with No Name trilogy or the Dollars trilogy when officially they're not related?
Clint Eastwood, mostly. Yeah. I think it's because it's the face that is present in all of them, and that's primarily still how has always been how people talk about cinema, and will be still for some time. His is the most prominent face, and that face is in any of these movies. His is the most prominent face, and that face is in all three movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and
no, and I think Leone got incredibly lucky getting somebody that was going to be a megastar and getting them at just the right time, and being able to successfully keep him around for two additional movies.
Yeah, getting him for so cheap, and someone who is undeniably just such a magnetic movie star
and absolutely perfect for this type of role, because like the thing Clint Eastwood does the best is stand and be present, you know, like he's not the best at delivering lines, and he's not the best necessarily at like running and jumping, but he's the best at just being a physical presence despite being rail thin and just kind of not really looking like a traditional tough guy, but he always is present, and his growl is wonderful, you know.
He is so pretty in some parts of I'm not joking, in some parts of The Good, Bad, and the Ugly he is so pretty that sometimes you wonder how, and then you know he not in the same movie walk up to a poker game that looks like a very high stakes poker game and just deal himself and one other person a hand. And I think that can come off as poorly written or goofy if you don't have the gravitas that he does. Like, and I think everyone just buys into it, because you're like, if I was at that table and 10,000 times tougher than I am now, I would for sure do nothing about this. Like, there's just no way. Anyway, what I was saying about him kind of lucking into something and these movies not really being connected, Clint Eastwood, yes, as you said, is very prominent in these movies and is the face of them, and you're right to say that. And in these movies, more so than a lot of other movies, when you're the face of a movie, your face is taking up 98% of the screen at times for good long shots.
These close-ups are like Michael Bay close-ups, but you rest on them for like 10 seconds at a time.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, yeah, so he plays... And, you know, a series of people in the trilogy, like Eli Wallach, play different people with different names. And Eli, especially between Angel Eyes and...
You mean Lee Van Cleef. Wallach's only the...
Yes, other. Totally do mean Lee Van Cleef. I'm very sorry. Yeah. They play different characters, and they play contradictory characters. You know, they go very clear-cut way. And there was a point where Leone had to prove that Fistful of Dollars was not a sequel to, or For a Few Dollars More was not a sequel to Fistful of Dollars, because one of the writers was trying to get money out of the fact that they did something, you know, based on his movie.
Yeah.
So officially, they're not a trilogy. Officially, Clint Eastwood plays a different person in each one of these movies. But, you know, between Leone, Morricone, and Eastwood, and some of these other players, it's really lumped into this trilogy. And I think one of the really cool parts is that the chronology is really messed up.
Yeah.
It's pretty much in reverse by most people's understanding of technology and the few dates that you see. Tuco and Angel Eyes in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, just because of translation, they are misassigned who's the bad and who's the ugly, depending on which version you're watching. Mm-hmm. And because of the way that the actors had to say their lines and then dub them in, or say nonsense and then dub in the proper English or, you know, proper language later, there's this really weird mythology to it all. Like it's like so many of the myths and legends that you would imagine would be around in the old technology to keep these things straight, you know. Yeah. And you don't know what's a myth and what's true and what's fact and what's fiction. And I think that's something that was a result of, you know, as I said about A Few Dollars More not being a sequel to A Fistful of Dollars, that was a matter of litigation. Sometimes we have matters of mistranslation, sometimes we have budgetary reasons, but there's all these differing factors that Leone couldn't possibly, or anybody couldn't possibly, have control of, making these movies into a myth and having what looks like one person from the not be the same character in the next one. And I just think that's something that makes these movies, and one thing that I like about the Old West and Westerns in general, all these people and all these events are so mythological and so ethereal that there isn't this straight line that could be drawn between the characters. It's not a straight line in the chronology of these characters. And I think that's something that's definitely lucked into for, you know, a series of factors I just said that to what I think a lot of people like about the Old West, that that there's just no way that it could have been planned ahead, yeah, and there's no way that it could be controlled, but something that really elevates these movies to not just a story, but, you know, but to myth and legend and to something that has been extremely influential in all of cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think tying into your point, like, it's like you said, Clint Eastwood isn't playing the same person each time, but he's playing the same person each time, you know, like, and I yeah. think that says something interesting about the actor's persona, like specifically Clint Eastwood's. And you can, I think Lee Van Cleef, you know, with his history in Westerns, it's kind of interesting to a lesser extent to him. But I mean, we're just seeing Clint Eastwood develop his persona that he would then play off of for so long in varying different ways. You know, Dirty Harry is just a different version of The Man with No Name, you know? He's slightly more verbose and he's in San Francisco, but there's still, you know, it's still kind of the same thing. The gold is just a person that he wants to murder now. But, you know, and it's kind of interesting, and especially, you know, when thinking about superstar actors and how important persona is to all of them, the way people will, you know, I mean, there's kind of the famous story about Will Smith, how he would point to all of these things that he had to play in the 90s. He had to play like a superhero. He had to be in a comic book movie or whatever. He had to fight aliens, whatever the things that he, or a Western, that was Wild Wild West. all the things that he felt he had to be in to become the biggest American superstar. He needed that, his persona to exist in all of these things, but he still had to be the same person in every movie so that people could identify with him in the same way. And Clint Eastwood kind of has that and is building that in these movies. And specifically because these movies ask him to do what he turns out to be the best at. And I think these movies work as an interesting conversation about specifically his persona and in a wider sense, persona, an actor's persona as a whole, you know, just because of how much his presence offers, specifically the second and third movie, I guess you could say, you know.
No, absolutely. I think, I mean, I love Clint Eastwood, and these movies are a very big part of that.
Like, there's a reason when the time came for Leone to pay him way more than he had earned up to a point that they had to do it, you know? And when The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly comes around, they had to pay him, I think, $250,000, whereas he'd been paid $15,000 and $50,000 in the previous two movies. And there was just no way around it. Like, you just needed him, you know?
Yeah, and I think that it speaks to kind of what I was saying about the Western, and that the incongruity between all these movies. You know, he picks up the poncho at the end of one movie, but chronology says he should be wearing it before you know, like, and there's all these, you know, it's the Civil War now, but didn't he just, wait a minute, didn't his heel get stepped on in for a few dollars more? Why is, you know, or sorry, his hand gets stepped on by that guy's heel. There are all these things that make it, you could make such a logical argument about how none of these things are in a straight line. There's all these dates on newspapers and the cartridge of gun and the material that the military is using on uniforms for the soldiers. There's all these things where you can make this perfectly logical argument why these movies are not a trilogy in the traditional sense of the word. But then there is these things that are pervasive in all of them. There's this kind of quintessence to these guys, a quintessence, if you will. there's just something so undeniable. There's just this intangible quality that goes through the three of them that as films, they can't be separated from each other. And I think it's exactly what you're talking about. There's a reason that even if they didn't have, they think they didn't have the money, there was something about Clint Eastwood that made this what it is. And you could say, oh, well, he died at the end of, he fucked off at the end of this one. There's all these excuses why it wouldn't make sense that he's back. But there is the most powerful excuse in the world that no one can articulate why he had to be back.
Yeah, exactly.
Why all these movies truly are in the same very powerful, influential vein.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he's a damn G.
That's it. Yeah. Should we talk about these individual movies at all?
I guess we kind of should. I mean, I don't even know. Like, I don't have anything to say about Fistful of Dollars. Like, it's good. You know, I enjoy it.
Okay.
I feel like there's not a lot of interesting stuff in that movie. I don't know if you feel differently, but like, I was trying to, when I came up with that that thing with the man with no name putting these two rival families against each other, like, I was like, I need to have a take on this movie. I need to see a meaning in it, you know? And the face off between the rifle and the pistol at the end, you know, like, I think one says, let's see if that's true about one being quicker than the other. Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about Fistful of Dollars.
Okay, well, let's move to a few dollars more then.
Well, do you have anything to add?
No, didn't even watch it.
Is Lee Van Cleef in that one? No? Okay, moving on. I actually think,
Lee Van Cleef is fantastic in these movies.
Oh, of course. I mean, I thought that was implied. He's the best. But anyway, of course. Anyway, I don't know. I like For a Few Dollars More as a movie as a whole. I like it the best of the three. There are some things in it that I think are really great. Oddly, I think the cinematography is the worst in For a Few Dollars More of the three, which, I mean, being the worst of three Leone spaghetti westerns is still like a pretty gorgeous movie. There are just more mistakes in this movie than in anything else. Like, characters are weirdly framed or something like that. But I don't know. There's something about, I think, that movie as a whole that kind of works better for me. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly has the highest of highs. Like, the last 25 minutes of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is just some of the best directing in the history of cinema. Like, it's unbelievable. Once they get to the cemetery, pretty much, it's just perfect. It's absolutely perfect.
I think it's probably the strongest open of the three, too.
It does, yes. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the strongest open?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I would agree with that as well. And Leone gets better at opening movies as he goes on. Once Upon a Time in the West is 5 minutes. The opening 5 minutes is waiting for a train, and it's the best thing in the universe. Anyway, but yeah, for a few dollars more, I like kind of the through line that exists in it. I like how Clint Eastwood kind of isn't really the main character. It's more, it focuses at least as much on Lee Van Cleef's character. I would argue it focuses a little bit more on his character. Certainly the emotional part of the movie focuses on him, and I just really like every scene with that kind of like stopwatch of sadness, you know, with those chimes. I think that stuff is so good, and again speaks to the macro versus micro sensibility of these movies, where all of these things are happening, but the only thing that matters to Lee Van Cleef is what this guy did to his sister, you know. And even just the way that act seems to have an effect on Indio, the villain of the movie, him seeing the sister, or Lee Van Cleef's sister, kill herself while he's raping her, and that seems to actually have an effect on him, and he's kind of haunted by his own actions, which is something we don't see a lot in these movies. And I feel like those things in For a Few Dollars More add a certain element that I don't think is present in either of the other two, or is much more fleeting when it does exist in the other two.
Yeah, and I think that suicide rape scene kind of gets built to in a way, like, the way that he is emotionally disturbed by that before you know what the cause of it is. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's not, when that scene happens, you're expecting it to let you down or be underwhelming in a way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this is kind of the only villain that's had this side to him mm-hmm. in these movies. And I think it's done well. I think it doesn't disappoint, even though that's hard to do, to build up to something that has this really strong, often very singular within the trilogy character trait. Mm-hmm. You know, we have bad guys with good streaks, but we don't have I don't think it's done as a character is done kind of multifaceted as well as it is with him.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's good about it.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
I think you're right that Lee Van Cleef's character is more of it. And especially because it's hard to do anything emotional with The Man with No Name.
Yeah.
For for obvious reasons. I think there are times that it does work. I think, you know, when he says, because you remind me of someone and, you know, there was no one there to help them.
Yeah. That's in Fistful of Dollars, I think, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But though, I think, though, I mean, within the trilogy, I think there are moments for him to do well, but I think we don't want him to do all that as big all the time. And that's why I think it was really important that Lee Van Cleef did that and did that successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, Lee Van Cleef, even in that movie, still, they set him up as this hardened man as he's stopping the train to Tucumcari and stuff. Yeah, it's great. Oh, this train will stop at Tucumcari.
It did. I did get off. Yeah, that's so, so good.
Yeah, no, it's great. And what another thing I like about his character being this kind of hardened guy is that we see the source of it. And again, it's the only movie where we see not only repercussions, but the actual action, or sorry, you know, emotional repercussions, but the actual action that led to those feelings, you know? And it's the most human of the movies to me because of that, you know?
Yeah, like I said, with The Man with No Name, you can kind of piece together, oh, your mom probably got killed when you were young, but we don't see that as we do with him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, and just one more thing about the macro versus the micro and something you were just talking about. I think geography is a big part of the Western, and I think it has West in the name of it. Mm-hmm. And when we think about the Western genre, I think in this trilogy especially, we think, you know, wide open vistas and landscapes and desert, and then these small towns, and that the way that the cinematography expresses that these great big grand things and these small things successfully, I think is thematically so in sync with the West. You know, we have these long journeys, speaking to no one, and then they get into these small towns where everybody knows everything, and mm-hmm. you know, these shoeshine boys or whatever could tell you who all the new strangers are, and you know, there's all these familiar relationships that you come into, and oh, this guy basically kidnapped this woman, now this guy can't see his kid, and you know, these grand expansive areas and these huge moments of time pass even within some of these movies, not necessarily just in between them. You know, Blondie walking home from the desert or there is that in that part of life. There is these huge things and then these very small things. There's these wide open spaces and then these small towns. There are these big wars, you know, civil wars of hundreds and thousands of men dying, and then the one that is closest to you really has the impact. You know, we see so many times of people dying, Man with No Name counting up his money and bounty with the big wagon full of dead bodies, played off for laughs, but then it is successful in, you know, those scenes you were saying, like that rape scene, in certain deaths and certain reveals in this movie, the way that these movies succeed in doing those things both so well, I think is a testament to the old West that these movies are all based in, and the spaghetti Western that these movies are so emblematic of.
Yep, absolutely. I guess we should talk about The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly for a bit.
Yeah, we should, because it's seen as one of the best films ever made.
Yeah, it's quite good. It's quite good. The things that I want to say don't really... I don't know. Okay, I feel like this movie's too long. And I know that's a complaint a lot of people have about a lot of movies. It's a complaint I almost never have. I think this movie's too long.
Yeah, it's Sergio Leone in the first two. Well, sorry, even the first one. It's clear he's a very confident filmmaker. Be so repetitive with some of the music, you know, having these scores and these themes for everybody. And, you know, opening a movie just on someone's face with no explanation, you know, for a long time. Mm-hmm. And to make some of the changes to the genre that he did, he's very confident and very sure of himself. I think that the massive success of the first two made him a bit too confident. And so there's just some visual things in Good, Bad, and the Ugly that I agree, I think, are a little too much. And not that the other ones are understated by any means for the most part.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get that criticism.
All of the too much for me, it's all of the Civil War stuff. Like, I could use way less of that stuff. I think the things that they get across in so much time is just not that interesting to me, because the thing about all of these grand civil war, even the action sequences, is that it removes the thing that Leone does that sets him apart from other directors of such grand movies, is that he has
small things big.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He has to show the big things in the wide shot, and everybody can frame that up if you've got the budget. Like, I could frame up a shot. Like, there are shots in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly that, you know, the framing is just so standard, just because it has to be to fit all of these things into it. And, you know, the highest points of Leone's career come in this movie. And I think some of the lower points of his career come in this movie, too. And I think it's all for this little tiny criticism that are like, I mean, his movies always got criticized for being too violent, and The Good, the Bad, the Ugly was no different. And it felt like a man commenting on the way his movies are talked about, in that he's like, oh, you think my movies are super violent? Well, how about the Civil War? The Civil War was incredibly violent. Like, the things that I'm doing or I'm showing in my movies are so small compared to American history, you know? And yeah. I think that's one, I mean, seems really petty, and also two, just kind of, it was just so much for so little. You know?
Yeah, it's more kind of reactionary than making good choices for the sake of good choices, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's my beef. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, and I mean, it's tough to separate the two and know why and what, how much the success of the first two impacted the others, or impacted the good, bad, and the ugly. But I do feel that, as I said, even though he was extremely confident, the success of them, and I think the desire to have up the ante, whether it be from you or from the higher ups, mm-hmm. I think really rears its head in this. And, you know, the body count being up, the runtime being bloated, I think is reactionary to that.
Most directors that make the movies of this scale want their movies to be bigger, you know, and right. all through history of blockbuster directors, Nolan's this way, Michael Bay's this way, James Cameron's this way, everybody, you know, D.W. Griffith probably was too. Every movie they make, that they want it to be bigger than the one before, because they've done the smaller thing, you know, they're done with it. When you're smart enough to direct a movie this big, you don't want to continue directing movies of the exact same size. You know, you want new challenges. And I think that Leone is part of that. So
no one should see The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
No, it's a terrible movie. Piece of trash. No, I have to say,
it's the ugly of the trilogy.
Yeah. the sequence when, and I think this really speaks to how talented Leone is, the sequence when Tuco stumbles upon the graveyard, the Morricone song that plays in the background is called The Ecstasy of Gold, and it's just him running around the cemetery, and it's probably about 3.5 minutes, the sequence, and it's one of the most beautiful things in the world. It's just such a it's Tuco running around, like, trying to find this thing that he knows he's in the right place, but there are so many headstones in that cemetery, right, that he has to find Arch Stanton's. And what really helps set it up is this dog that's in the wide shot with him at the very beginning, as we're sort of seeing this whole cemetery. And what he's doing is basically a dog running with no, you know, he's got no set destination. Like, he knows where he wants to end up, but he doesn't know geographically where that is. Yeah. And I think that sequence and the music gets across the feeling of that scene so strongly, and the shots get more and more confusing and distracting but abstract as the sequence progresses, and Tuco is slowly eliminating options and therefore must be getting closer and closer, and he's being driven delirious by this possibility of this gold, and the confusion's palpable, the excitement's palpable, and the direction is so disorienting. He's running from right to left, and the camera, like, you can tell the camera operator is just doing a rotation around the tripod and doing it so quickly, and still maintaining this beautiful shot. And it's kind of like what we talked about in The Graduate, but it happens before The Graduate, where they remove the sense of place from the shot, and it just kind of it kind of shows him just in this place that he knows he's supposed to be in, but he doesn't know the specifics about it. And I find the way that sequence gets across this never ending quest to get such a specific goal and such a small, you know, comparably small goal of money is just really interesting. And I think is kind of, it's Leone's most impressive sequence to me, despite the fact that it doesn't involve any violence at all. And I think that I always find that scene really fascinating when I watch it.
Okay, so we can see Good, Bad, and the Ugly now?
Yeah, yeah, you can see it. But you can skip to the last 25 minutes, basically.
Okay.
No. Anything else you want to add?
Nope.
Okay, that standoff immediately following the Ecstasy of the Gold sequence is unreal as well.
Oh, I thought we were going to end this podcast with 25 minutes.
Well, that's the problem. One, we've already said 14 times as many words as it are in any of these movies. Yeah. We can't really do it justice because the next 30 minutes of this podcast has to be you and me staring at each other and occasionally touching gums, you know, like we just, so I feel like it's not really great for an audio medium.
All right. I guess we'll end the podcast.
Yeah, we might as well. All right. Thanks for listening. We're going to go have a gunfight.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.